A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel's been thinking about the people who maintain the roads we drive on every day. He points out that most of us only encounter Hy-Vee's clothing in two settings, watching baggage handlers from an airport window and driving past a road crew. And he wants to talk about that second group, because Hy-Vee's was developed specifically for them, in response to a fatality record that was, in his words, unacceptable. He's asking three things: what the day-to-day work actually involves, how accurate the popular image of brutal immigrant exploitation really is, and whether safety has improved over the decades. So, today we're spending time with the people who keep 4 million miles of American pavement from falling apart, and the piece of fabric that was supposed to save them.
And that fabric has a story that most people have never heard. It starts with dead workers and ends with a standard that took 30 years to write. So let's start with the scale of what we're talking about, because most of us have no idea how many roads there actually are.
4 million miles of public roads in the United States alone. Every single mile needs ongoing maintenance. Repaving, pothole repair, bridge deck replacement, guardrail repair, drainage clearing, signage replacement, restripping. This isn't a one-time construction project where you build it and walk away. It's a permanent industrial operation that never stops.
And the workforce is enormous, but weirdly invisible. The Bureau of Labor Statistics counts roughly 450,000 highway maintenance and construction workers, but that number is almost certainly an undercount. A huge portion of the workforce is temporary, seasonal, and, this matters for the exploitation question Daniel's asking, often undocumented. The industry runs on a subcontracting chain where the workers at the bottom don't show up in official counts.
So the popular image of immigrant workers doing brutal road work for low pay, that's not a stereotype someone invented. It's a structural feature of how the industry is organized.
Right? And to understand why Hy-Vee's exists, we need to understand what those workers actually do, and what was happening to them before anyone thought to put reflective tape on a vest.
Because the thing most people picture, someone standing there holding a stop sign, that's maybe 5% of the job.
Let me walk through the actual tasks, because each one has its own specific fatality profile. Asphalt paving, you're working directly behind a paver that's laying down material at 300 to 350 degrees Fahrenheit. Workers are walking on fresh asphalt, raking it, checking the grade. The burns are serious. Concrete finishing is different. You're on your knees on fresh concrete, which is chemically caustic. Prolonged skin contact causes cement burns that can go deep enough to require skin grafts.
That's before any vehicle hits you.
Then there's milling. That's when they grind up old pavement with these massive rotating drums. The drums throw debris at high speed. Workers near a milling machine are getting pelted with asphalt chunks and silica dust. Bridge painting is its own nightmare. A lot of older bridges still have lead-based paint, so you're doing abatement in full respirators, often suspended under the bridge deck. Drainage work means entering confined spaces, culverts, storm drains, where the atmosphere can go bad fast. And then there's nighttime lane closures, which is when a huge portion of road work actually happens, because you can't shut down a highway at noon.
Working in darkness with vehicle headlights and temporary lighting, while cars whip past at 70 miles an hour a few feet away.
And before the 1960s, those workers wore their regular clothes, a cotton shirt and jeans, no reflective anything. The Federal Highway Administration and state DOTs started collecting fatality data in the 1950s, and what they found was stark. Struck by vehicle incidents were the leading cause of death, not falls, not equipment accidents, but being hit by a motorist who didn't see them.
What was the number?
In the early 1960s, the annual fatality rate for highway construction workers was approximately 30 to 40 per 100,000 workers. For context, the average construction fatality rate at the time was around 3 to 4 per 100,000. So road workers were dying at roughly 10 times the rate of other construction workers. And the mechanism was almost always the same. A driver didn't see them until it was too late.
That's a crisis that demands a specific solution. You can't engineer the cars away. You can't stop the work. So you have to make the worker impossible to miss.
And that's where the chemistry gets interesting. The first fluorescent safety vests were developed in the 1960s using Day-Glo fluorescent orange dye. That dye had originally been developed for military air-sea rescue. The idea was that a downed pilot in a fluorescent orange life vest would be visible from the air against the ocean. Road construction adopted it because the physics of fluorescence solved a specific problem.
Walk me through the physics.
Fluorescent materials convert ultraviolet light into visible light. So when UV from the sun hits the fabric, the material actually emits visible light. It's not just reflecting existing light, it's generating new visible light. That means the vest looks brighter than the ambient light level would suggest. And the key insight was that this effect is strongest at dawn, dusk, and in overcast conditions, which is precisely when most struck by incidents were occurring, because those are the low light conditions where a driver's eyes are struggling to adjust.
So the vest isn't just bright, it's actively fighting the exact lighting conditions that were killing people.
Right, and then there's the retroreflective element. That's the silver tape you see on Hy-Vee's vests. It's embedded with tiny glass beads, the same technology used in road signage. When headlights hit those beads, the light bounces straight back toward the source. So a driver sees a bright flash exactly where the worker is standing. Fluorescence handles dawn and dusk, retroreflection handles nighttime.
And how long did it take from this technology exists to... this is required by law?
That's the part that should make you angry. The first statewide mandate was Florida DOT in 1967. But the first ANSI standard, ANSI/ISE 107, which defines what actually counts as Hy-Vees, wasn't published until 1999. That's 32 years where the technology existed, the fatality data was clear, and there was no consistent standard for what visible enough meant.
So a worker in one state had a proper vest, and a worker in another state had... what?
Whatever their employer felt like providing, a faded orange t-shirt. A vest that had been through 3 seasons of wear and lost its fluorescence. Because fluorescent dyes degrade with UV exposure, which is a dark irony given that UV is what makes them work. The dye molecules break down, and the vest stops fluorescing, but it still looks orange in daylight, so nobody replaces it.
The thing that's supposed to protect you is being destroyed by the thing that makes it work.
And OSHA didn't require Hy-Vis for all workers on federal aid highways until 2004. That's an update to Subpart G of 29 CFR 1926. So we're talking about a 40-year gap between the invention of the technology and the federal mandate. 40 years of workers dying in ways that were preventable with a piece of fabric.
So the vest was invented, but did it actually fix the problem? And what about the other problem? The one about who does this work and how they're treated?
Let's take the safety numbers first, because the improvement is real. The fatality rate dropped from roughly 35 per 100,000 in the 1960s to approximately 12 to 15 per 100,000 in the 2020s. That's a dramatic decline. The biggest drivers, and this is where it gets beyond just the vest, were 4 things.
Hit me.
1. Mandatory high-vis clothing, which we've covered. 2. Temporary traffic control standards. The Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, the MUTCD, which standardized lane closure setups, taper links, buffer spaces. Before the MUTCD, every state was doing its own thing, and some of those things were lethal. 3. Positive protection devices. Concrete barriers and truck-mounted attenuators. Those crash cushions you see on the back of maintenance trucks that absorb the impact of an errant vehicle.
The thing that looks like a giant yellow accordion.
That's the one. A truck-mounted attenuator can absorb the energy of a vehicle hitting it at highway speed and save the workers behind it. And 4, nighttime work policies. Many states now require double the Hy-Vee's coverage for night work, including reflective trim on pants and hard hats, not just the vest.
So the numbers got better. But you said the current rate is still 12 to 15 per 100,000, which is still multiple times the average construction rate.
And that's the gap that remains. Road construction is still one of the most dangerous jobs in the United States, more dangerous than logging or commercial fishing on a per-hour exposed basis. The reason is that the fundamental hazard can't be engineered away. You can make a worker visible, but you can't make a distracted driver look up from their phone.
There's a number there, isn't there?
A 2022 study from the University of Texas found a 15% increase in struck-by fatalities in work zones since 2015 correlated with smartphone usage data. Decades of improvement, and then smartphones arrive and the line starts going back up.
So we invented a fabric that glows in the dark, wrote a federal standard, built crash cushions, redesigned the entire traffic control system, and a guy scrolling Instagram just undoes it.
That's the thing about safety engineering. You can control the work environment, you can't control the driver, and the workforce demographics make this worse. The workers who are most exposed, the ones actually on the pavement, closest to traffic, are predominantly immigrant, often undocumented, with limited English proficiency. They're less likely to report safety violations, less likely to file injury claims, less likely to push back when an employer hands them a degraded vest.
Which brings us to Daniel's second question. How accurate is the exploitation picture?
It's accurate, but the mechanism is more specific than roadwork is brutal and immigrants get exploited. The Davis-Bacon Act of 1931 requires prevailing wages on federally funded highway projects. That means the base pay, on paper, is often decent, $25 to $35 an hour for experienced workers. But the subcontracting structure creates a race to the bottom.
Explain the chain.
A state DOT awards a highway contract to a prime contractor. The prime contractor subcontracts portions of the work to smaller firms. Those firms subcontract to day labor agencies. Those agencies recruit immigrant workers, often undocumented, for cash wages far below the prevailing rate. A 2019 investigation by the Economic Policy Institute found that wage theft, unpaid overtime, off-the-clock work, misclassification as independent contractors affects an estimated 30 to 40% of highway construction workers in states like Texas, Florida, and California.
So the law says one thing, and the subcontracting chain makes it unenforceable.
Because by the time you're four layers down, the worker doesn't know who their actual employer is, doesn't know what the prevailing wage is supposed to be, and isn't in a position to complain because they're undocumented and a complaint means deportation.
And the safety equipment follows the same hierarchy.
That's exactly where I was going. The OSHA standard requires the employer to provide high-vis. It doesn't specify quality, replacement frequency, or fit. A $5 vest from a discount supplier meets the letter of the law. It's got the ANSI label. But the fabric is stiff. It doesn't breathe. The reflective tape is stitched on with a single row of thread that starts peeling after 2 weeks, and the fluorescence degrades in a month of sun exposure. A proper $50 vest, breathable fabric, heat-sealed reflective trim, UV-stabilized dye, meets the spirit of the law.
And who gets which vest?
The foreman gets the good one. The union crew gets decent ones. The temp workers at the bottom of the subcontracting chain get whatever is left.
When we talk about Hy-Vee saving lives, we have to ask whose lives?
That's the question. The safety revolution is real. The numbers prove it. But the revolution only reaches the workers who are already visible to the system. The ones with union cards, the ones on the books, the ones who can file a complaint without risking deportation. The workers who are invisible to the system are also the ones wearing the least effective safety equipment.
We've been talking about this from the data side, but I want to bring in someone who's actually stood on that pavement. Hilbert.
I spent a summer on a road crew in rural Montana, 1998. I was 19, needed money, and a friend's dad got me on a crew repaving a stretch of Highway 2. I lasted 6 weeks.
What happened?
I watched a guy named Miguel get hit by a side mirror from a semi that drifted into the closed lane. He survived. The mirror caught his shoulder, not his head, but he went down hard on the asphalt. The vest he was wearing was this faded, threadbare orange thing that had been passed down through three seasons of workers. Basically a dish rag with reflective tape peeling off. The foreman had a brand new ANSI Class 3 vest with silver stripes. The regular crew had hand-me-downs. Miguel and the other temp guys got whatever was left.
A vest hierarchy.
That's what I called it. I didn't know the term then, but it was the most visible thing about the crew who got the good vest and who got the rag. Miguel was undocumented, being paid $8 an hour cash. He didn't complain about the vest because he couldn't complain about anything. After he got hit, the foreman gave him the rest of the day off and told him to ice his shoulder. He was back the next morning.
Was there any kind of incident report?
No. The semi didn't stop. Nobody called it in. Miguel didn't want anyone asking questions about who he was or why he was there, so the accident never happened, officially. That's the thing the fatality statistics miss. The near misses. The injuries that don't get reported because the worker can't afford to be noticed.
Is that still happening today, or was that a 1998 thing?
I don't know the current data, but the OSHA standard hasn't changed on this point. It says the employer has to provide high-vis. It doesn't say it has to be good high-vis. It doesn't say you have to replace it when the fluorescence degrades. It doesn't say the temp agency has to provide the same quality vest as the prime contractor. A $5 vest meets the letter of the law.
The standard is written as if all vests are equal, and all workers receive the same protection.
They're not, and they don't. The foreman on my crew, his vest probably would have protected him from a side mirror strike, or at least made him visible enough that the semi wouldn't have drifted in the first place. Miguel's vest was invisible at highway speed in low light. The reflective tape was peeling, so the retro-reflection was gone. The fluorescence was dead from months of sun. He was basically wearing a dirty orange t-shirt.
The temp agency that hired him had technically complied with the OSHA requirement by providing a vest with an ANSI label, regardless of its condition.
That's correct. I kept the vest, not Miguel specifically. I bought one just like it at a surplus store a few years later because I wanted to understand what I'd been looking at. The ANSI label was still legible. The reflective tape came off in my hand when I pulled on it.
The label outlasts the protection.
The label outlasts everything. It's sewn in with better thread than the reflective tape.
That's a detail that's going to stick with me.
The other thing that stuck with me was the temperature. It was August in Montana. The asphalt was coming out of the paver at about 300 degrees. The air above it was shimmering. Miguel was working 6 feet from the paver, raking the edge. He was wearing the vest over a long-sleeve shirt because if you don't cover your arms, the asphalt splatter burns you. So he's in a long-sleeve shirt, a polyester vest that doesn't breathe, standing next to 300-degree asphalt in August. The heat was brutal, and the vest made it worse. It trapped the heat against his body. A good vest with mesh panels and breathable fabric would have been uncomfortable. This one was dangerous in a different way.
Heat stress.
Yeah. Nobody was tracking that either. We had a water cooler. That was the extent of the heat safety program.
The thing I keep coming back to is that the safety standards we've been discussing, the ANSI classifications, the OSHA requirements, the MUTCD traffic control setups, they're all designed as if the worker is a fixed point in a system. You put the vest on the worker, you put the cones out, you set up the buffer zone, and the system works. But the worker isn't a fixed point. The worker is a person with a specific position in a labor hierarchy, and that position determines whether the system actually reaches them.
That's what I saw. The system worked for the foreman. It kind of worked for the regular crew. It didn't work for Miguel.
The system recorded Miguel's near-miss as a non-event because nobody filed a report. So the data that drives safety policy is systematically missing the workers who need the protection most.
I don't know what the fix is. I just know what I saw. The best hierarchy was the first thing I noticed, and it was still there on my last day. I assume it's still there now.
The best hierarchy is real. And that brings us to the question of what comes next, because the technology is changing, but the human dynamics might not be.
The next frontier in road worker safety isn't better vests, it's vehicle-to-worker communication technology. Several pilot programs are testing connected vehicle systems where a worker's vest transmits a Bluetooth or dedicated short-range communication signal to approaching vehicles. The car's dashboard lights up with an alert, "Worker ahead, slow down." Some systems can even trigger automatic braking.
That shifts the safety burden from driver needs to see the vest to car sees the worker, whether the driver is paying attention or not.
That's the promise. It bypasses the distracted driver problem entirely. But it only works if every vehicle is equipped with the receiver, which means a federal mandate, which means a decade of rulemaking and litigation. And it raises a privacy question. If every worker's vest is broadcasting a signal, you're tracking their location in real time. For an undocumented worker, that's not a safety feature, that's a threat.
The same workers who can't complain about a degraded vest also can't risk wearing a vest that broadcasts their location to a network.
The same subcontracting hierarchy that determines who gets the good vest will determine who gets the smart vest. The foreman gets the one with the Bluetooth transmitter and the breathable fabric. Miguel gets the $5 passive vest that doesn't broadcast anything. Which, in a connected vehicle world, means his vest is invisible to the system that's supposed to protect him.
The technology leapfrogs the people at the bottom.
Every time.
Here's the misconception I want to nail down. People think high-vis was invented for road workers. It wasn't. Fluorescent materials were developed for military air-sea rescue, pulling downed pilots out of the ocean. Road construction adopted the technology after a fatality crisis that was killing workers at 10 times the rate of other construction jobs. The vest was a solution borrowed from a completely different problem.
The second misconception, that safety has improved so much that road work is no longer dangerous. The fatality rate has dropped dramatically, but it's still multiple times the average, and smartphone distraction is actively reversing some of those gains. The hazard is fundamentally the same as it was in 1960, a human body next to a moving vehicle. The vest makes the body visible. It doesn't make the driver look.
The next time you're stuck in a construction zone and you're annoyed about the delay, remember, the people in those vests are doing a job that kills them at a rate 10 times higher than the average worker, and the only thing between them and a distracted driver is a piece of fabric that glows in the dark, assuming they got the good one.
That's the open question I keep coming back to. We've built this elaborate safety ecosystem, the vests, the standards, the traffic control setups, the crash attenuators, and it works, on average. But the average hides the hierarchy. The workers who need the protection most are the ones least likely to receive it, and the data that would reveal that gap is systematically missing because the injuries go unreported. The next generation of technology might close the gap, or it might make it worse. It depends on whether we design the system for the workers who are already visible, or for the ones who aren't.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us honest, and for reminding us that the view from the pavement is different from the view from the dataset.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you want to send us your own questions about infrastructure, safety, or anything else you've been staring at through a car window, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear host. Until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.